Okay, got that recording. Okay, welcome everyone and those who are joining us after the fact. This is the office hours session for week 9, if I'm not mistaken, of the Principles of Economics class, winter 2011 edition. And as always on these things, I'm just going to cater to the people who showed up. So Cindy right now is asking me a question, so we'll go ahead and start. She says, in my reading of the Mises website about the subjective theory of value with respect to how goods are priced, the article seemed to be saying the price of a good has nothing to do with the cost, that it is strictly a function of the subjectivity on the part of the consumer. I've also read in certain Austrian defenses of open immigration that prices of agricultural goods would increase if illegal immigration were eliminated because the cost of labor of the illegal immigrants is cheaper. I know I'm missing something critical. Would you mind explaining this apparent contradiction? Okay, that's a good question. Hang on 1 second.
Hey, buddy. Remember, I'm trying to teach, so can you go play in the other room, please? Thanks, buddy.
Okay. It's a little bit tricky. I understand what you're saying about the immigration, but we don't even need to deal with immigration per se. We can just make it more general and just say, you know, interpret your question as being when Austrians stress the subjective theory of value and say how it's ultimately consumer preferences that determine prices, do they mean to suggest that cost has no bearing whatsoever? And then if the cost of producing something goes way up, that's not going to affect the final price of the product? Okay, so the answer to that question is no. That's not what Austrians are saying. I'm trying to think of the easiest way to explain this. Historically, you kind of need to know what the Austrians were rebelling against. Historically, the classical economists, so even, you know, generally free market economists like Adam Smith and guys like that, they had what was a cost theory of value, and then in some cases it was arguably a labor theory of value. So if you ask them, you know, what... Hang on 1 second.
Buddy, Clark, you can't be in this room, okay? Because you're making too much noise, so please go in a different room, okay? If I have to ask you again, you got to go upstairs, okay?
The way the classical economists would explain the prices of products, like if there was like a stagecoach that was very expensive, had a high market value, and then there was, I don't know, a piece of a fish, a single fish that wasn't that expensive, didn't have a high market value, how would the classical economists explain that? Well, they would ultimately say it had to do with the fact that there were more resources tied up in the stagecoach and that it took more, you know, it was more expensive to build it, and ultimately it took more labor power and other resources to make it. And that's why it had to command such a high value in the market. So what the subjective value theorists did is they overturned that approach. And they said, no, you're not really hitting the essence of it. Really, you know, the first thing to understand is, you know, why would somebody pay so much to acquire a stagecoach? It's because the marginal utility of that stagecoach is very high. Okay, so the same principles that we used in this class, principles of economics, the subjective value theorist used, with more fancy terminology and, you know, harder examples and things like that. All right, so they're saying that's the first thing, because, and the way you see that is to say, look, just it can't be the case that a high cost of production causes something to have a high price. All right, so it's not that cost determines price, because, you know, I could say, well, this, for the stagecoach, what if the people building the stagecoach told all the workers to tie one hand behind their back when they were building the stagecoach. And then it would take maybe twice as many or more hours of labor to build the stagecoach, but they couldn't go around and then charge twice as much money for it. Okay. And so you see, you know, silly examples like that just show you it's not that putting a lot of work into something per se makes the final product valuable to people and explains why they're willing to pay a lot for it. So ultimately, you know, at step one, why are people paying so much for one product versus another? It's because the buyers get more utility from the thing that they're willing to pay more money for. Okay, so that's where the Austrians are coming. And so that can explain everything. Like, even if you're just, because another problem with the cost or the labor theory of value is, what if you're out in the woods and you just stumble upon, some stagecoach that was left there by aliens or something? Then, oh my gosh, and you just get it for free. You don't have to exert any effort at all. And then you go sell it in town. Well, you can still charge the market price for it, even though you don't have to expend much labor to produce it because you just found it. Okay, so those examples are just showing you that it's not the cost or the labor going into something that determines what its ultimate value is in the marketplace. Whereas, you know, the starting from the basics principle of what the consumers are willing to pay for it does help explain it. Now, having said that, does that mean that cost is completely irrelevant? Well, yes and no. I mean, so it's true, and like you're saying with the example of immigration, or, you know, if you want to say, what if the government comes in and levies a big tax hike on carbon dioxide emissions, is that going to make the price of electricity go up for consumers? Well, yeah, of course it is. At least, you know, because a lot of the electrical generation relies on coal-fired power plants that emit a lot of CO2. And so if the government taxes that, well, that's going to increase the cost of producing electricity, and ultimately you're going to see that in prices. But the point is, even there, it's not that the high price per se causes, or sorry, it's not that the high cost per se causes the price. It just means, because the costs of production are higher, producers aren't willing to make as many units as they were before for a given price, and so the quantity falls, and so then the marginal utility of the smaller amount is now higher. Okay, so it's still the case, like, let's use your example of immigration. So it's, if all of a sudden they close the borders down, or they do a better job of enforcing the border limitations and keeping out illegal immigrants, then yeah, the people who are in the business of buying or of hiring workers to pick fruit and then sell it to the grocery store, what's going to happen in terms of our diagrams is the supply curve of fruit is going to shift way to the left. Okay, but it's still the case that when you say, well, gee, now that apples are $10 a pound, why is that the case? Well, it's still true that the consumer in the store who picks up that bag of apples and pays $10 for a pound, that consumer gets more utility from that bag of apples than from the $10 bill. But what's happening there is, because the quantity of apples now is so much smaller, that the only people in the market are the people who really love apples, and it's like their first and second bags. Whereas with a lot of immigrant labor and tons of apples, those people would have been buying like 100 and 101 and 102 bags of apples. And so the margin utility of those units would have been really low, and because they would just keep buying bags of apples until the margin utility was lower than the price, when the price is really low, like what it is today. Okay, so that's kind of how it operates. But even there, and so that's why some economists, like mainstream economists, would say, look, you're fooling yourself. It's not that it's either all cost or all subjective utility. It's an interaction between the two. And so they think they're taking a middle ground, and they're going to say, yeah, it's supply and demand. It's not just one or the other. And that's a pretty standard mainstream, what's called neoclassical position on the matter. So that, in other words, they think the classical economists were wrong for trying to ultimately explain prices by reference to costs, but they think that the subjective value theorists, as represented by the Austrians, are also wrong because they try to explain price as being fundamentally about consumer valuation and subjective utility. And they're saying, no, it's an interaction of the two. That's how you figure out in practice what the equilibrium price is. So the this is getting almost philosophical, but the Austrians still don't think that that's quite right. They're going to say, yeah, if you're holding everything else constant, it's true. Somebody in business who you know faces prices for hiring different types of workers and sees the price of buying coal and electricity and buying steel and renting out factory space, and then seeing the prices of the possible things he could make, that it looks like costs and utility interact to determine what he does and what price he charges. But the Austrians are going to say, you know, that's a very superficial analysis, because what we're calling the cost of production are themselves prices. Okay, so it's in other words, it's not like we're trying to say, what's the price of peanut butter? Oh, well, you figure that out by saying, how much do consumers like the taste of peanut butter on the one hand, versus what are the cost of peanuts? So you see that the price of peanut butter is determined by both utility and by costs. But the Austrians might say, well, wait a minute, the cost of peanuts, what is that? That is the price of peanuts. And so if you say, how are the price of peanuts determined? Well, it's the utility to the buyers, some of whom happen to be the manufacturers of peanut butter. Okay, so still, no matter what thing you're looking at, there's something there that is being influenced by subjective valuations, and that's true no matter how far you push it back. So you're never going to get to something. Sorry for the freeze up there. So the point is, you're never going to push it back and reach rock bottom and hit something where there's just a raw cost involved, and there's not a thinking rational being using his preferences and determining, would I rather hold on to this resource or sell it to somebody for a certain price? Okay, so that's also, in other words, it doesn't make sense to say, no, there's utility and then there's costs, because the costs themselves are ultimately determined by the preferences of other people in the marketplace. Okay, so that's the, so I know that was kind of a long answer, but I hope I answered your question. So it's nobody, the Austrians stress the primacy of the subjective, or the role of subjective preferences when it comes to determining prices in the market, but they don't deny that, you know, if you have an initial equilibrium and then something changes to make one of the prices of an input go up, that might be passed along to the final consumer, as it were. But again, the mechanism is that the higher cost of what's called cost of production means the supply curve shifts left, so the equilibrium quantity drops, and so at the same with that given demand curve, the price goes up because of the lower quantity. So it's never the case that consumers are directly paying more money because they say, oh, well, it costs more to make this thing, so we'll pay you more. That's not what's going on. It's that the higher cost might reduce the available quantity, and then because there's less of the product to go around, on the margin, the utility of the last available unit is higher. And so that's why people are willing to pay more for it. Okay. Also, by the way, everyone, I apologize. I got a pretty bad cold yesterday, so I might be sniffling. Okay, Jeff says, could you explain the effects on non-union workers when a union is able to push wages above the free market equilibrium wage rate? Okay, to think this through, it depends on how we model it. Well, if Yeah, so I think the way that like Mises and other Austrians would normally tackle something like this is to say that the union can achieve higher wages for its members, possibly, but at the expense of causing unemployment among non-union members. Okay, so if we take the situation like this, that originally you've got the supply and demand and the equilibrium, you know, in the labor market, let's say, supply and demand in the labor market, and the equilibrium wage rate is $20 an hour. Okay, and at that wage rate, there's a certain quantity of workers who are employed. So now a group of those workers gets together and they say, let's form a union. They say, okay. And they do that, and then they go to the employer, or you know, the various employers, and they say, okay, you have to hire the people, you know, we're now collectively bargaining, and we want to get paid not $20 an hour, we want to get paid $25 an hour. And you know, and so normally if they were just making voluntary proposals, the employer would say, well, no, I'm not going to pay you that because I know there's plenty of workers who are willing to work for less. So why would I offer you that? If you don't want to work for $20 an hour, you can quit. And then, you know, the wage rate will, what that would mean in our diagrams is that the supply curve of labor would shift to the left a little bit. And because those people now aren't, you know, willing to work for the same wages, they insist on higher wages. And then, you know, the equilibrium wage rate would be a little bit higher. Okay, but a lot of those people making demands would be out of a job if they refused to work for the going market wage rate. So if instead though, but if they have power and you know they got muscle and they say, well, no, if you don't cater to our demands, look, we've got 30% of the workforce organized, we're going to stand outside your factory and picket. And if anybody tries to go in and work at $20 an hour, we'll hit them upside the head. We'll take a 2x4 and smack them. And so, you know, the employer then would realize it will be impossible to continue business operations if 30% of the workforce is picketing outside the factory. And so, because you can't get other people to come in because the union people call them scabs and beat them up. So then in that environment, what would happen is in terms of our diagrams, yeah, you would have, it would be like a minimum wage law. It'd be like the same analysis, except here, the floor on the wage rate being stuck at $25 an hour above the intersection of the supply and demand curve would be maintained by the threat of union violence as opposed to the threat of the government fining you or putting you in jail. And so so what happens is at the higher wage rate, you know, if you move along the same demand curve for labor, because the employer is the one that has the demand for workers. So remember, in the labor market, the supply curve represents the workers and the demand curve represents the employers. So if you artificially push up the price, which is the wage, then you're going to move left and up along the demand curve, meaning at the higher wage rate, employers want to hire fewer workers, which makes sense. At that higher wage rate, fewer workers are hired, but the union, if they have that kind of muscle and they're that organized, they can make sure that they're the ones who get those jobs. Okay, so let me just repeat that again. If originally the price, the wage rate that balanced the quantity supplied and demanded in the labor market is $20 an hour, and then the union comes along and says, no, we're going to shut you down unless you start paying $25 an hour, that won't bring work to a standstill. The employer, you know, can afford to pay $25 an hour. It's just he won't hire as many workers because, you know, there's that demand curve for labor, and the higher the prices, the higher the wage rate, the less labor he wants to hire. But at $25 an hour, you just follow it out and, you know, there is a point on the demand curve. So he does want to hire some laborers, even if he has to pay $25 an hour. So if the union makes it so that he has to pay $25 an hour, he can stay in business. It's just he hires fewer workers. And so I'm saying the union can make it so that they're the ones who are that smaller pool getting hired. And so what that means is there's unemployment now. At the wage rate of $25 an hour, there are a lot of people who want to work but can't find a job because the employers don't want to hire that many people at $25 an hour. Because remember, at $20 an hour was where supply and demand were balanced. So if the union really does have that kind of clout, what's going to happen is who are the workers that aren't going to be getting the jobs? It's going to be the people who aren't in the union. Okay, it'd be the independent people. And so what's basically happening there is someone who's unemployed, who would love to work at $25 an hour, who would even love to work at $20 an hour, just can't get a job. And he could even, you know, if you say, well, what's happening? Why is the market stuck? Well, because normally he would just say to the employer, I'll work for $24 an hour. I'll work for $23 an hour. I'll even work for $20 an hour. And the employer would say, oh, okay, great. And that would eliminate the glut of workers. But in practice, he can't do that because if he tries to undercut the union, they'll beat him up. Okay, so that's the analysis. So it's in terms of supply and demand curves and charting it out that way, analyzing unions, at least the standard way that an Austrian probably would, it's very comparable to minimum wage law. So again, it's just with the minimum wage, the government says if we catch any employer hiring someone for less than this floor price, the employer is going to get hit with a big fine. And so that, you know, keeps employers from doing it. Whereas with unions, they say if we catch any worker who takes a job getting paid less than what we're declaring is the floor, we'll beat you up. Now, some people hearing this might be fairly young and not know if this is real. And I didn't, you know, I had heard stories about unions and stuff, but I mean, just to tell you one personal anecdote, my uncle was in construction and he told me this one story that, so I think he had to, you know, he had to join a union just because that was the way it was, that you couldn't get work if you weren't in the union, as he lived in Long Island and I think they were working in the city. And so it was a, you know, real union friendly political environment and, you know, crime families and big political machines and all that stuff. Okay. So he, you know, I don't think he was very ideological. I think he was just, he wanted to work. And so, yeah, okay, you joined the union. So he did. And then there was this one guy, this like real tough Irish guy that, you know, it wasn't clear, like, what was that guy's job? You know, so they'd go and be working on a building somewhere and that guy wouldn't be there, but yet he was on the payroll. You know, so he knew, you know, my uncle knew that, okay, this guy over here, he does this job, this guy does that job, he's the, you know, lather, he's the electrician, blah, blah, blah. But what does that guy do? And that guy's job basically was to go beat up people. And so he would, because he was a real tough guy. And so my uncle said he would do stuff like he would go to some site where, you know, there was a crew working on a job, and he would walk up and say, you know, just, hey, what chapter are you guys are? I don't know what the terminology is, but like, what union affiliation are you? And they would say, oh no, you know, they just kind of blow it off and just, you know, and they just sitting there working. He'd go, oh, and he would just pick up a piece of lumber from the ground. Oh, and just boom, and just start whacking them. Like, literally just walk up to them and just start beating them up. And it's, you know, you're not used to someone doing that. And so, you know, that's the thing. So that was how it was, they were able to exert their muscle like that. And then, like I said, also, I mean, they were in big cities, the unions are connected with the mafia and so forth. So anyway, it's not just something that's mythical. I mean, you can read about accounts like, you know, I've read things written by people who are in organized crime families and how they operate, because they'll do things like the mob will be trying to shake down some building contractor, right? So some big company gets a bid to maybe with money from the city or something to start building maybe a low cost, a low income apartment unit you know, in a blighted area. And so then the mafia will go up to the, and I'm interchanging the terms mob and mafia. I know they're distinct terms. They'll go up to the guy and say, okay, you know, you're going to hire our company and give us a kickback. And, you know, you're going to use our union to do this. And if they don't play ball, then all of a sudden it's like, just work gets really slow on the project. Okay. That, you know, so I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was somebody from the city or something that was like, and this one anecdote that I remember, somebody from the city was like outside the work site. And so when trucks are trying to come into the work site, you know, come and go, like there's a checkpoint, and it was somebody from the city that was there, you know, personnel, I don't know if it was a cop or who, that was looking at, you know, the trucker would pull up with the materials that the people inside the, you know, the fenced in area needed to be building the skyscraper or whatever they were doing, building the apartment complex. And the trucker would show the paperwork to the guy sitting at the gate, and he, you know, be looking it over and like, okay, well, wait a minute, what company are you from? Okay, so this, are you sure this is going here? And he'd like, let me look in back and make sure. And so he would just take really long. And so, you know, the trucks would back up and they couldn't come and go from the work site because the guy working the checkpoint was just dragging his feet. And so the people running the project knew we have to give the kickbacks and such to these mafia guys so that, because they control the unions. And so, you know, we can't, because there's also unions of government workers. That's the part of the story I was leaving out. And so like the police are in a union. And so forth, or whoever, you know, I don't remember if it was a police officer or somebody else, but the point is, it wasn't like the building contractor had the authority to fire the person who was working the checkpoint and hire someone from a private security firm. He, you know, the city assigned that person, and he was powerless to get rid of it. And so my point is, it's, they have a lot of ways of bringing pressure to bear on private businesses because the government, it gives a nod and a wink to these practices. Okay, while you guys are thinking of another question, I'm going to go run and grab a Kleenex. I'll be right back. Okay, so Cindy says, what do you think about the investor Jim Rogers? Do you think we all should be following his suggestion that we learn Mandarin and move to Asia? Even though I respect many of his Austrian-type views, the track record of several of the Asian countries, for example, China and Singapore, in terms of human rights concerns me. I saw Jim Rogers when he was given the... I forget what the award was. At the Mises Institute, I guess it was last year. So he's, you know, very dynamic public speaker and just exudes. I mean, it's, how can I put it? He's exactly what you would hope some billionaire investor would be like, you know, in terms of his personality and everything. So, and how he can just pontificate on all sorts of things. Because in order to be a very successful investor, you have to be pretty competent and know a lot about a lot of things. Like, you can't just be an expert in one little area and make $1 billion doing that, because there's other stuff going on. You kind of have to have a big picture, but you also have to know enough to be able to out-invest all the other millions of people trying to make money. So anyway, it wasn't a surprise after you hear him speak that he is the kind of guy he is and that he was that successful. In case people don't know what you're talking about, so Jim Rogers, he is a world famous investor, billionaire, and his big thing lately is he's saying he moved his family to, where did, Cindy, do you remember exactly where he moved? Was it actually China or was it somewhere else? But anyway, he wanted his daughters to grow up being fluent. Okay, so he moved to Singapore. He moved his family to Singapore. So he wanted his daughters to grow up, you know, being fluent in Mandarin, because he thinks that the China. So he said, like, Great Britain was the country of the 19th century. The United States was the country of the 20th century, and he thinks China and other, you know, Asian nations are going to be the region of the 21st century. And so that's why he, you know, he thinks he's going to give his, so he thinks by moving to Singapore, that would be equivalent to somebody in the early 1900s moving from Europe to the United States. And that's clearly where you would want to be if you wanted to, you know, have your family become successful. So that's what he's, where he's coming from. And part of his reasoning is, which I think is right, is he thinks there's massive price inflation coming. And so he thinks that the thing you want to be in for the next decade or two is commodities, like things that are like, so he thinks farmers are going to do much better over the next 10 years than stockbrokers. And he thinks, you know, that kind of bubble and that the stuff that New York and Chicago have built themselves up on in terms of finance, or more like New York and London, I should say, that's going to be relatively less important 10 years from now, whereas the countries that have actual raw materials and natural resources and arable farmland, that those are going to be the people that are going to do relatively well. And also because in terms of the political trajectories, he's saying a lot of the Asian nations, it's true, they're starting out with not free societies in our definition, but they're moving in the right direction, that they seem to understand the benefits of economic liberalization, and they keep signing free trade agreements and, you know, lowering their taxes and things like that. Whereas in the Europe and the United States, the Western democracies, they are moving in the wrong direction. So even if it's true that right now you have more freedom in the United States than you would in China, Jim Rogers thinks that in terms of economic growth and everything, that it's because the trends are going the opposite directions. It's, you know, I don't know if he thinks it's going to actually reverse in the near future, but the point is the U.S. is going to be more and more crippled, whereas China is going to be more and more freed up. So to answer your question, Cindy, I mean, it's, no, I don't think the answer is every single person hearing me right now should move to Asia. So, I mean, because there's a lot of things going into a decision like that. So I'm not moving because I have family here. You know, I have a young son, and I, you know, wouldn't want to take him over. And I think I'm going to make my stand here, if you will. And I know full well that the U.S. is moving in the wrong path right now. But if somebody's 18 and doesn't want to go to grad school and, you know, wants to go have an adventure and start life afresh, then, yeah, moving to Asia might be a good thing to do. So I'm really not sure. Again, there's just so many different factors going into a decision like that. But in terms of the reasons Jim Rogers gives as to why he moved his family, I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think that makes a lot of sense, the reasons he gave. Okay, you guys got any other questions? There's nothing magic about the hour time limit. If you guys don't have any more, we can wrap it up. But there's technically... Okay. Well, if you guys are all set then. All right. So thanks for tuning in, and I'll see everybody next week for the final lecture. So long.